This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
I'm going from Smith Street to Mars today. Where are you going?
Well, I'm doing a bit of a wander down Swanson Street.
Great.
And war.
Okay.
In many other places.
Off you go.
It was Winston Churchill who rallied the troops with his speech. We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall never surrender. But he didn't say anything about dying or returning to your loved ones, physically and emotionally changed. Lenny Robinson has written about these consequences in her book, And in the Morning. Welcome, Lenny. What a book.
Oh, Jen, thank you so much, and thank you for having me.
Your book starts with Lil and her 3-year-old son, Ted, rushing through the streets of Melbourne. When and why?
I think I said it in Melbourne, I guess, because it's familiar to me. That's why I chose that as a location. And so Lil's running to meet her husband, and he's been away for 4 years fighting in the Middle East.
They met on a farm way, way north. In fact, let's hear a little bit from page 26.
He was different from other men. He could lay his hands on a horse's withers and draw the wildness from its eyes, coax a mare to foal. He moved in places she could only imagine. Red dust, gnarled scrub, cavities in the earth where the water no longer ran, and seemed to know their intentions. Even the boss listened when he spoke.
Lil's story is of longing. She longs for the time when she first met Bertie up at this Weira, up on a run further north, and she fell in love with him. Then there was the drought. So what did he decide to do?
He decided to sign up. So he rode to Sydney. He went to Liverpool to sign up for the war. And at that time, they would have groups moving through the country, actively encouraging men to enlist. So that was his decision.
So he went across. Mm-hmm. He wrote letters about breaking in horses and climbing the pyramids. Lil was pregnant when he left and moved close to her sister in Melbourne and put her love into her son. As you say, 4 years later, Bert came home. How did that go?
Well, he comes, I guess, from Lil's perspective, she knew Bert for a very short time before he left for war. He's been gone for 4 years and he's come home a different man. And the differences are subtle. You know, he's not going to talk about the war. And so she begins to notice that difference, I guess. The romance that she's built up in her mind crashes up against the reality of the man who's returned to her.
Oh, yes, it's the longing for that past love. But she's got the son, and she's a good, strong woman, that Lil.
Great.
So we jump 30 years to 1949 and follow the story of Frankie, and she has hope. Why did she enlist? In fact, it's so good. 129. So this is what happened in her small country town. A woman came and said,
"What," she asked, "could they do for their country? Our soldiers did not need hand-knitted socks and balaclavas, and our medical personnel did not need help rolling bandages. What our country needed," she said, "was more men. And to free up the men, what Australia needed was women willing to do the work of men. Women who could fix planes and drive cars. Women who could learn Morse code and transmit cipher. Who could operate teleprinters and radar equipment."
And she could do all of that. Well, she learned to do it. So she left the country area, and she came down to Melbourne too. And she's made new friends in the WAF. Dot and Bobby, who are much more confident. They're off on a Saturday night down Swanson Street, where there's a lot of khaki brown with patches of Air Force blue. So who do they meet?
So they go to a dance at the Trocadero, which was located kind of where the Arts Centre is today. And they meet a young man called Jock, who Bobby has already met at the Dugout, which was a services club. And through that, they meet Eddie, who's a young man in the Air Force.
So they finish the dance because a lot of them can't dance, which I thought was really cute. And they go on a tram going to a chevu in St Kilda. And a chevu was a word of the time.
Yes, it was. And it just kind of meant a party or a get-together.
Now, this was a wonderful time warp moment for me because on the tram, there's a tram conductor punching tickets. The Americans are also in town and there's tension between the soldiers on the tram. And Frankie's further impressed with Ed, this new man, who is older and more responsible. What does he do on the tram?
Well, he kind of sits there. There's a fight ensues on the tram between the Americans and Jock, and Ed kind of sits away from it for a bit. And it is only really at the end, after the tram conductor, the tram driver comes down to break up the fight, that he steps in and kind of lowers the temperature of everything. And it's in that moment that we get a sense of this is a man with some command that comes from a quietness within him. A stillness.
He is a bit older than Frankie, and she spends the night with him, not like that, sitting on a beach, talking about their lives and their hopes and why they enlisted. And he said, I just wanted to see something else. I figure I'm going to see paddocks and milking sheds till kingdom come. This is a chance for something else. She said, I just wanted to make a decision that was mine. But when the sun goes up, he'll be gone.
Mm.
He returns after the war, still with hope, but not health.
No. He had been in a Japanese prisoner of war camp in that time.
A weak heart and a permanent cough, but proposes in hospital. And she said yes.
Yes.
And I love this. He smiled, quote, trying to hold his mouth closed to hide the wreck of his damaged teeth. And they marry, and something old, something new, something borrowed. Well, the borrowed was definitely the wedding gown handed mm-hmm. around. And something old?
Something old. Well, she has a whole list of possibilities of old things because this is post-war, but of course Ed was her something old.
Okay. We're going to jump again. And now it's 1969, Vietnam War, conscription. And it's a mother, Fran Gibson. What's she just been told?
She's just found out her son, who was a conscript to Vietnam, a Nasho, that he's been killed in the war.
Look, it was only 18 months ago. She'd been up to Pakapanyul for his passing out parade. She'd taken his best friend, Leanne, from next door. She was going up there for a slightly different reason.
Yeah, Leanne, she's gone on a different trajectory. She's got involved with the anti-war movement in Melbourne. She's, despite the fact that politically her alliance is very different, she's still very close to Robbie, and she accompanies Fran up for that moment.
Fran feels the maternal guilt of not stopping him, mm-hmm. although one doubts whether you could. Mm-hmm. He really had a wonderful 18 months prior to this. And she remembers the maternal guilt from her past, threatening him with a wooden spoon of its time. She remembers she'd kissed him on the forehead every night until the day his voice cracked open and the man stepped out. Mm-hmm. Lovely. Could she give her son Robbie one last kiss?
No, she couldn't, because the nature of his injuries meant that she's told that she can't see his body. I guess they're trying to protect her.
Ah, look, and the funeral, the grief. This is beautifully written by you. Just the grief that you've conveyed. How did you do it?
Well, I guess it helps that I have a son. So at the time I was writing the book, he's 12 now, so he was quite a bit younger. And I used to write at dawn because that was the only time I had time to myself. And every morning the writing period would stop with him coming and crawling on and sitting on my knee. So I guess I was constantly reminded of that love and that vulnerability we have for our children. And I think I was channeling a lot of that.
The title of this book is And in the Morning. So do you think something about your son coming in every morning added to this?
It's so interesting. I mean, the title was chosen because it's part of the ode, but also mornings played such a big role. I realise that throughout the book I talk a lot about sunrises. It's probably because I looked at so many of them during the time
it. And she says, anger. She was really cross that the world kept turning despite the enormity of her loss. So we have three stories told in part. After each segment, you leave us wondering what will happen next. How hard was this plotting?
It was difficult. I knew very early on that I wanted to have three narratives, and I knew I wanted to interweave them, which everyone said to me was quite a crazy idea because it was going to be very difficult to manage. But the way I did it was I wrote each narrative completely and separately. So I wrote all of 1919, all of 1942, and all of 1969. And then I physically printed them out. I went away to put the manuscript together, and I physically slotted them in, reread it, and then worked out what I needed to put where to make it work.
It's brilliant. And we find that their lives do actually connect in some way at the end. We started with Winston Churchill, and now we finish with some of Lil's words. She had known men who were destroyed by the war. Some took it out on their wives, tyrannized their children. Others retreated and retreated until they disappeared. Mute bones lost in the clothes of the men they once were. You've won the Quinton Bryce Award.
Yeah, I was very excited and honoured to receive that. It's given to a book that celebrates the lives of women and girls by a woman who's done a huge amount to advance the situation of women and girls in this country. So it was a great thrill.
Longing, hope and grief are emotions shared by women in the mothering of a child, and if that son grows up and goes to war, also by their wives. Lenny Robinson has written stories of women, war and motherhood, about taking of life and giving it in and in the morning. Oh, Lenny, wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you, Jan.
Well, some people burn out like a supernova, fantastical one minute and a black hole the next. Jordan Prosser builds his debut novel, Blue Giant, around one such character whose incandescence is simultaneously spectacular and infuriating. So, Jordan, welcome to 3CR.
Thank you so much for having me.
Abby Horn, the central character, flawed, not just flawed, she's mind-blowing. Blowingly flawed, taking things to excess. What's she like?
She is outspoken and abrasive and speaks her mind at all times and sees herself as sort of existing above the common people. I think she's constantly bemoaning what she sees as the moral and aesthetic decline of civilization.
But she's sort of permanently drunk and drugged to the eyeballs.
Correct. Numbing the pain of life in the 2020s.
But she shares a flat with Nikita, who's almost diametrically the opposite.
Yes, a much more measured person. They've been friends since high school. They've grown up in each other's pockets. So that's the central relationship in the book. And it really is about sort of spending your life with a person and the time when you begin to question, is my entire life going to be spent with this person? Have we grown apart or have we grown up together?
But how do you explain Nikki tolerating Abby?
She's a good friend. And she's also, Nikki is a person who's much more willing to sit in the uncomfortability and sort of the vagaries of life, sit in the grey area, whereas Abby sees everything as one extreme or another. So Nikki's far more accepting of imperfection and contradictions, whereas Abby, it's just this or it's that, and there's no in between.
Nikki's more practical and likes to support people.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's one of her best attributes, which again is something Abby couldn't relate to. Yeah.
They are diametrically opposed in that regard. I'm just wondering, we've all had occasions when we've shared houses with people we haven't got along with. But how much then is Abby a sort of everyman character?
I think the key here is she certainly sees herself as that. I think she's in, you know, some big inspirations for this book, books like, you know, classics like Catcher in the Rye or A Confederacy of Dunces. Like, the characters in those think that they are everymen. They think that they're just kind of trying to self-actualize and live their best life. Actually, they see themselves as above the everyman, and the book ultimately is about them learning how to live among the rest of us.
But how much does she represent everybody like us, because we all seem to be on that same trajectory. I mean, Abby is looking for purpose, but is simultaneously self-destructive. she comes across Tor Skovgaard, the Danish tech guy. And what's he promoting?
He has a fledgling startup called Mars Now, which is a sort of a thinly veiled recreation of an actual Dutch startup from 10 years ago called Mars One that I was reading about a lot when I first came up with this story. And the plan was to send people on a one-way mission to colonize Mars, broadcast all the footage back to Earth like Big Brother in space, basically. That's how they were going to fund the entire project, billions and billions of dollars that they needed.
But this is now starting to become a piss take of what's going on in
absolutely.
Life in terms of Big Brother scenarios, funding, and these sort of schemes that are just almost astrological in dimension. Mm. You're not making a side remark here about Elon Musk at all?
Oh, perhaps? No, not at all, not at all. Although I have said the thing about Tor Skovgaard is he's actually much more... In a way, he's actually much more likable than Elon Musk, I think. He still has some concept of good taste and humility at certain stages, whereas I think the tech bros of today are so extremely craven and gaudy in the way they treat other people and the way they see the world.
But they're super salesmen because, I mean, how practical or logical is such a scheme?
Not at all. And that's the point, really, is I think the Mars One mission, this real-world company that went completely bankrupt in the late 2010s, sending approximately zero people to Mars, I think it's just a great stand-in for so many of those false or broken promises of the tech industry of
and
the last 20 years.
We are so susceptible to these schemes. We believe in them. We want to believe in them.
Because they promise connection, they promise celebrity, they promise eternal life and glory and all these things without actually any substance behind those promises.
And this is the thing that Abby falls into. It actually gives her purpose in life. And this begins her journey in a way, because one of the first things she's got to do is find a gimmick. What's the gimmick and what's it for?
Well, that's, I guess, the idea of the competition in the book too is also looking at this idea of finding purpose but lacking meaning. You know, she has plenty of things that have animated her in the past. She's been a fashion designer. She tried to be a celebrity yogi. She went to Thailand to try and save the endangered tigers. And none of these things have worked out because they're all just quick fixes. They're all things that she thinks will make her rich or famous or useful, but none of them actually really fulfill her. And so the Mars Now mission is just the latest in a long line of things that she thinks will fulfill her. And part of that is finding the thing that makes her unique, finding this gimmick that will set her apart from all the other applicants.
But she's already got it. This is the irony.
This is the irony, that she can't recognize that in herself.
Well, you know, because she's a seamstress, basically. And then she meets up with Oscar Woolley because she's training. Where is she training? What's she doing? And who's Oscar?
She has watched a few videos of NASA astronauts. And for their zero gravity training, they go to the bottom of like a giant Olympic-sized International Space Station training pool. And so her equivalent of that is taking a kettlebell to the Fitzroy pool, jumping in the deep end, sinking to the bottom and trying to solve a Rubik's Cube, because she sees it as being, you know, testing her mental acuity in a low gravity environment. So again, anyone reading, anyone watching knows that this whole thing probably isn't going to quite pan out, but the scale of her delusion and her dreaming, I suppose, is such that she's blind to
it. But the wonderful thing about this delusion is Oscar Woolley at the pool.
Yes, yeah, who she meets, and she insists we are never going to be friends. Of course, they might well become friends, but he is someone basically unlike Nikki, who is actually going to enable her delusion because he's applying for the same competition. So they become training partners.
Partners and friends in a way. And so this sort of fly-by-night scheme, or this you know, Mars scheme, actually leads to something constructive.
It does, but Abby, of course, refuses to see that initially because she actually has a list of all her friends and family who she's going to be cutting off contact from. So she says to Oscar, we'll never be friends. We are professionals. We are colleagues in the spirit of human pioneering. But yes, these things sneak up on you, don't
they? But then with this getting rid of friends then leads to another sort of sideline where she goes to a school reunion. And that's quite an intriguing affair because everyone seems to be out for revenge.
Everyone is out for revenge, but the revenge itself is also another gimmick, you know. And I think all these sequences in the book are kind of just real-world examples of what we are all like online, as in trying to find the thing that sets us apart, trying to find the thing that makes us special, even if there is no substance to it. And yes, the school reunion turns into a complete schmozzle.
Yeah, and with invective-laden schmozzle. But again, getting back to this notion of every man, it's the trajectory that a lot of us are on. But also then, we can sort of step out here because we have a correlation between Abby and the planetary system.
Yes.
Very early on, Nikki says, you have a tendency to get very excited by new things and invest a lot of yourself in them. I mean, it's beautiful, really, the way you're able to commit yourself so wholeheartedly. And then you get this description of the planets. Red giants are enormous, as the name suggests, perhaps 1,000 times larger than our sun. They're expanding as they die, but they're actually cooling quite rapidly. It's the blue giants you have to look out for. They live fast, die young stars.
And that's why they're the perfect stand-in for Abby as a character. She sort of burned through all of her energy reserves, burned through all her resilience and all her capacity for wonder, and that's left her in this state of essentially turning supernova.
But are we getting to a sort of existential parallel here, where the planets are on their set trajectory? Does that mean it's the same for all of us, set on a trajectory?
You could argue that, and I think Abby's story is really about a person trying to change their fate, trying to change the gravitational pull that the world has on them, trying to break free from what she sees as her predetermined orbit.
Can we?
Well, I think the book is arguing that it's not so much about changing it, it's about finding satisfaction in the orbit that you're in.
Yeah, and appreciating.
Yes.
So, you know, the friends you meet while you're sitting on the bottom of the Fitzroy Pool.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
I mean, Wooly's taken, Oscar is taken in by this notion of Abby gives him a gift of a spacesuit that she's made.
That's right.
So, you know, there's these delightful things. But here we go. The way you tell this story, it's full of wicked satire. And it's a send-up, really, of a lot of our own behaviour. One thing that took me, Nikki is a photographer, very practical. She's taking headshots of actors. But what is it about these headshots and these actors?
Well, that's her day job. Obviously, she dreams of having a career as an actual photographic artist, and she's been working on her own side project. But the way she makes money is just by supplying headshots to, like, VCA drama school graduates. And the, you know, suffice to say, her heart is not in the work.
But they all look alike, and they all look alike,
and they in the book at least they all have the same name. They're indistinguishable. It's just this factory line of handsome young men who all think that again they are destined for greatness.
And if you've been in the acting industry, you know exactly what
I used to be. I have had a fair few of those headshot sessions myself, so I know just how impersonal and humiliating they can be.
Yeah, and how unrevealing they are.
Precisely. Again, a perfect emblem for something that is incredible. Incredibly glossy on the outside and sort of nothing on the inside. You know, a good headshot doesn't mean you're a good actor. Just like an interesting gimmick doesn't make you a good astronaut.
You're not being disparaging about our acting industry.
I would never. I would never.
Now, when the Mars Now project collapses, we're not giving too much away here. Abby's flight to Los Angeles is told in a chapter that consists of one extended paragraph. And in fact, if I've got a bit of time, and I'm throwing paperwork around here everywhere, but it'll give you an indication. Like her mother's postcards on Dr. Dylan's ink blot tests, Abby's first and final trip to America unfolded for her as a series of impressionistic freeze frames, snippets of action and feeling that might have been wholly abstract if not for the basic awareness that she had embarked on a linear journey from Melbourne to Los Angeles, yes, but also from day to night, from one hemisphere to another, from anonymity to infamy, from innocence to brutality. And so it goes. I won't read the whole chapter, but there you have it. But here's the irony, because the Mars Now project has collapsed. Abby's on her way to Los Angeles to confront Tor.
She's thrown everything into this project, and now when things don't pan out, she essentially believes she has nothing left to live for other than revenge.
But she's sort of stymied at the end, and I'm not giving everything away, but Tor is basically depressed, and Abby finds, as she approaches to kill him, that he's actually wanting to commit suicide.
Well, and is there anything worse than, you know, again, she's built up this huge symbolic victory in her mind just to find that this, you know, the villain of her story is someone who's essentially as depressed and flawed as she is.
So would it take the punch out of killing someone.
Of course. Of course there'd be no fun in that, would there?
So, you know, you're going to have to read the book, of course, to find out what eventuates in that scenario, because you actually twist it again in terms of that. But basically, the message, is there a message in this book, do you think, given all the satire and the send-up? Still holds a message.
I think so. And I think it's what we were saying before about those planetary orbits, you know, and it's about how the simply putting your head down and getting on with the necessary work of life, it's not very marketable. It's not very sexy. You're never going to see, you know, people telling you to aspire to do that. And yet that's sort of what we have to do, both to continue the work of being alive and to be able to exist with each other.
And the best thing about this novel and is that in the final chapter, before the epilogue, but we are on Smith Street in a cafe. Mm. So all we have to do to find purpose in life, Jan, is to go out the front door of 3CR to a cafe, and that's where this story ends. And there we have purpose in life. What could be better? The book, if you want to go to Mars, the book to read is Blue Giant by Jordan Prosser, and it's a University of Queensland Press release, and it's Jordan's debut novel.
And my author, Lenny Robinson, is also published through UQP, and her book, And in the Morning. Thank you both.
And now we have a special program. You've just been listening to Published or Not on 3CR.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.